And as a guy from New Jersey, thank you so much for all your films. They've always meant a lot to me. So having you on the podcast was something I'm very much
What part of Jersey?
Lawrenceville. It's in Mercer
County.
Oh,
I know where Lawrenceville is. Right,
it's Central Jersey. It exists, people. Central Jersey is a thing.
It's a real place.
Yeah, it's a real place. There's an argument there, but no, it's true.
All right. Special episode of One More Hollywood Podcast. I'm Chris Moore, sorry. I assume by this
what
point people know
Holy
who I am.
Crap, man.
Nailed it. No, just knocked it out of the park.
Breathtaking. That's why he can enter the podcast game so late, kids, because Chris Moore was going to bring something we never heard in podcasts. Dramatic pauses you can drive fucking trucks through.
It's always good to have people known you a long time come on your podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, to continue this train wreck, hi, I'm Dennis Inobly.
And I'm Katie Murphy. And today we are very excited to have Kevin Smith joining us.
Happy to be here, kids. He really needs an intro. You are confoundingly right, Katie. As much as I would love to hear an intro, okay. Everyone's just like, there he is, Kevin James. And I'm like, I don't even correct him. I don't correct him because if they think I'm somebody more famous, I'm okay with that.
Do you want me to do it? I could do the intro. We got one.
No.
No? All right.
You know who he is.
A man who needs no introduction.
For years, my bio, you know, they ask you to include him, like the press kit and stuff, just got like ridiculously. It started to look like a Wikipedia page. So what is it about 10 years ago, I just started, the bio is like, he made Clerks and that's it. And then people were like, we need more. And I was like, he made Clerks, got married, had a kid. You know, I keep it kind of simple. So yes,
there you go.
I that's what I'll say on my there fucking tombstone. He made Clerks and everything else. It was all downhill after that. Everything else. Was
Silent
just,
Bob, yeah. rest here.
Yes. In a desperate attempt to be relevant, he made a series of movies after Clerks, but he could have stopped at the first one.
Kevin, one of the reasons you were one of the first people we called up, besides being a podcast legend and having started before people even knew what podcasts were, was that I give you a lot of credit, and we had Mosier on, also the two of you, for championing Good Will Hunting when we were leaving and sort of telling people. And I just, you know, I think it's, it's not often people really push for other people's work. And I just thought that was a wonderful thing. And
that
in that case,
it was easy. Number one, we were all young. The thing that I didn't really think about until years later in life was that I would, at that point, like I was probably at the height of like whatever my abilities or powers would be. So like, you know, I'm still around, don't get me wrong, and I could still get stuff made, but they're not coming to me going, what do you got? Like, you know, I have to hustle to get stuff made and stuff. But back then, you know, Clerks, Mallrats died, but then Chasing Amy and Dogma kind of put me back in a really great place, ensconced me more or less. And that was when Good Will Hunting kind of came into the picture between Amy and Dogma. And Ben, who I knew through Mallrats, he had introduced me to Maddie at a screening of Mallrats, our first screening after the mix that we had at like the Alfred Hitchcock stage in Universal. And I had known about that Good Will Hunting script because I, like, for a while, even before I met Ben or Matt, because I read about it in Variety. It was a story about like these two kid actors who wrote a script and sold it as a spec script, $800,000 it said. And I was like, wow. So I'd read that in the trades. Ben came in to audition for Mallrats. Jim Jacks, who was our producer, who had also been a producer on Dazed and Confused.
Dazed and Confused, right.
He was like, oh, Ben Affleck's coming in today. Don't let him come in. Don Phillips worked as the casting director on both movies. He was the guy who discovered Sean Penn for Spicoli and Fast Times. He discovered Matthew McConaughey for Dazed. For us, he discovered Jason Lee for Mallrats. So he had brought Ben in, and Jim was mad because he's like, oh, I don't need him on this movie. I said, why? And he goes, because he's got potty mouth. I said, what does that mean? And he goes, you know, we brought him out of Days Confused. There are too many F words in that script. And then Ben just like ad-libbed a bunch more. He's gone, we don't need that on this movie. So Ben came in for Mallrats. And the first thing I said to him was like, wow, man, what are you doing here? Like, you just sold a fat spec script. Like, why are you auditioning for this movie? He's like, how do you know that? And I was like, I read the trades. He's like, you read the trades? I was like, yeah, we're all in this business together and stuff. Correct. I was like, but, you know, this movie pays like scale. So, you know, if I was you, I wouldn't even be here. And he goes, well, I like Clerks. So I knew about Good Will Hunting from before I met him. Then I met Matt at that screening, and they had already been talking about problems at Castle Rock. They had set it up at Castle Rock. Andy Scheinberg, Scheinman, one of the partners there. Wanted to direct. He had directed Little Big League, so it's not like he was like a crackpot. He had been a director. He had directed, so to speak. And this was an amazing script. Anybody who read it would have wanted to direct it because you knew it was like your ticket in for whatever. So he wanted to direct it. The boys didn't want him to direct it. They loved Gus because Casey had worked with Gus on To Die For. And so they were always leaning toward Gus. So this is the way I know the story, and Chris will correct me if I'm wrong. The Castle Rock folks got frustrated with the boys because the boys had say-so. They could literally say who gets to direct the movie, so they could stop and did stop Andy from directing the movie. And that was creating a bit of a consternation at that company to the point that they allowed the boys to take the script out. They were like, you guys could take the script out and try to sell it. You got a window. It was like a month to sell it or something like that. But if you don't sell it in that window, it comes back here and our deal with you is off in as much as we can pick whoever director we want. We may replace you two because the boys were connected to it. So there is a chance that it might have gone to like the two then It boys who were like Leo and Toby or something like that. So Ben, you know, who I'd only known for a short time, thanks to Mallrats, had been telling me like in the post on Mallrats, like these problems with Castle Rock. So he eventually said, like, hey, man, this thing happened. They gave us a window. You work at Miramax. Can you get into Miramax? And I was like, I can try, man. Send me the script. I'll read the script. Starts with that because I'd never read it. So he FedExed me the script because he couldn't just, like, email stuff. There was no email yet, or at least not in popular form. He didn't have email. I did. He didn't. So that was going to work. So he FedExed a script and I got it and I went into the bathroom, started reading it. And I didn't come out of the bathroom until I was done reading it. And I came out in tears. It's a beautiful script. 2 hours later, after I went into the bathroom, I roll out. My face is all red and wet from crying. Scott Mosier's like, that was a hell of shit. I was like, no. it's a hell of a script, man. I was like, this is crazy. Like, Ben and Matt literally wrote something that I was like, you got to read it. But I was like, I think this could win like an Academy Award. It's like way fucking smarter than me, than you, than them. Like, I don't know how this happened and stuff. So Scott read it and he was like, holy shit, this is amazing. I said, we got to call John Gordon. So John Gordon was our exec at Miramax. And I was like, hey, man, so we got a script, man. Like, that this is going to sound so fucking basic, but like a friend of ours wrote a movie and it's really good. And he's like, what friend? And I was like, Ben Affleck. And he was like, who's that? I was like, that was the guy who was in Days Confused, O'Banion. He's in Mallrats for Us as the guy, the fashionable male. As like him and his buddy was just in like Courage Under Fire, and he's going to be in The Rainmaker, Francis Ford Coppola's next movie. Like, he's breaking, this guy. And so they wrote this script and they sold it to Castle Rock, or the Castle Rock bought it. So I told him the whole history and he was like, all right, well, send me the script. Let me read it. Sent it to John Gordon. I think we actually drove it up to John Gordon because we were in New Jersey and he was in New York. John Gordon read it, and then the next morning he read it that night, because he called us the next morning. He was like, fuck, you guys are not wrong. He's like, this script is genius. And I was like, couldn't it win something? Like, this is so smart. And he's like, it really could. He's going, I'm gonna take it into, you can clench your assholes, kids, here comes the name, unfortunately, Harvey Weinstein. So he brought it into Harvey, and you know, Harvey was known for being cheap. The idea of picking up this script was expensive from the jump because Castle Rock had paid $800,000 for it. You were going to have to pay $800,000 for it, whoever wanted, plus turnaround costs. So you were looking at $1 million script. So essentially, me, Scott Mosier, and John Gordon were asking the studio, can you buy our friend's very expensive script? Like, it, by all rights, none of it should have happened. But the script was just that fucking good. And so they did buy the script. And then it went through a whole host of, like, first thing that happened was I was offered the director's chair by both Ben, Matt, and the guy who ran the studio. And I was like, look, I love this script, but I would be turning around the whole production to the two guys who wrote it to be like, what'd you see when you wrote this? So what would be the point? You might as well let them direct it. And that was never going to happen. So they went through a series of like directors, like the directors in town, like Mel Gibson wanted to, he met with the boys. He's like, I like the script. I like when the guys play grab ass and stuff like that. But he was the wrong guy for it. Daniel Stern, he wanted to direct it. I remember he came to the set of Chasing Amy to meet with Ben to talk about it. So when it was still over at Castle Rock, famously, I mean, at least in our circles, maybe the rest of the world don't know this, but like, what's his name? Chicago guy, Michael Mann.
Yeah,
loved the script, but he's like, I don't know about these guys, these kids. So I got to put them on film. And so he did a screen test with Ben and Matt for Good Will Hunting, shot two scenes. And tell me I'm wrong, Simu, like not cheap.
Nope, not cheap at all.
So somewhere in the vaults, like whoever, I guess Miramax stuff is owned by Paramount now. Somewhere in their vault is like footage that Michael Mann shot of two scenes of Good Will Hunting. They didn't wind up in the movie. He just shot them as a screen test for the boys.
Yep.
And eventually the boys, they got what they wanted. It wound up being Gus, which was the absolute right choice.
Yeah.
That was, you know, one of those things that like when it was all said and done, we were given co-executive producer credits because we like were smart enough to get the script from one place to another. And still to this day, if I fly on a plane, that's generally ever the only movie of mine that I'll find on a plane. I didn't direct it, but my name is in the credits, and it's a classic and stuff like that. On any airline, I don't exist except for Good Will Hunting.
Yeah, I guess they're not showing Tusk too much on the airplane.
No, I got so slobberingly grateful. I was like, who do I blow? When Delta was showing Clerks 3, I was like, oh my god, like this is so touching. But generally, my stuff don't play on planes. But thanks to Ben and Matt, I have one like that always plays because I have people in my world who love to do that. Like, oh, I was on a plane that had so many movies, not yours. And, you know, but now, generally they're like, you know, I'm like, did they have Good watching? They're like, oh, they did. I was like, well, that kind of counts.
Yeah, that one counts.
Yes.
Well, I also use it, Kevin, as just a great example of people looking out for good projects and being willing to somehow not have to make it all about them. So anyway, I'm grateful. I know they're grateful, and we've all known each other for a long time. The other thing that you know, has come up, and it came up with Scott a little bit, and this is more sort of for the people we know that are listening about sort of how you get in or what you do, is on a different note, we sort of thought about Clerks, and we were like, if you and Scott were you and Scott, and I know you met at film school, but say you met each other before film school, would you have made it as an independent movie? Or do you think it could have been characters on TikToks, or it could have been like a series, or like, what do you tell young people today how to start out? I mean, you're the king of this.
You're very sweet. Two different questions there. What would I do today? Honestly, I was on a sitcom set recently, and I was like, oh my God, I was raised by sitcoms more so than my parents. It is full of dad level humor, which I, like, that's my place right now. And it's like, you know, it's has this weird Friday night high school play vibe to it because of the live studio audience. Yeah. And as I was, you know, I'm a 53-year-old man, I was on this sitcom set, and I was like, why did this never occur to me? Like, why was it independent film? This world seemed impenetrable. That's why I never thought, oh, I know sitcoms. But now I'm like, wow, this actually would have made more sense based on like who I was. I'd been a fan of movies my whole life, but only like a fan of film for like literally 2 years before Clerks happened. So if I were to do it all over today based on like, cause I've been all over the spectrum, kids. I started as a indie filmmaker, and then somewhere along the way, like it being an artist making art wasn't enough. Suddenly I was like, wait, the artist could be the art. I could spin so many plates, do so many things that I won't, you know, be tagged as a director anymore. That was also self-serving because as a director, you get measured against other directors, right? Like, so if they're like director Kevin Smith, a lot of people out there are like, wait, so director Chris Nolan and director Kevin Smith, these two things, they can't, one of these things is not like the other. So I, you know, if I can be other things like podcaster Kevin Smith, stand up Kevin Smith, comic book writer Kevin Smith, TV host Kevin Smith, all these other plates that I've spun for like damn near 20 of the 30 years that I've been in business and whatnot, those, that seemed more interesting than just being a filmmaker over and over again, a director over and over again. But it also insulated me a little bit from criticism. In film, anytime I make a flick, it opens me up to the potential of getting torn down. Because let's be honest, criticism isn't just like, you know, it could have been better. Now it's a blood sport and very fucking tribal and stuff like that. So staying out of that realm, like, is beneficial to the self-esteem of any artist, particularly one who, like, went nuts last year and went away for, you know, for a while to Sierra Tucson. I backed off from social media for that reason because, you know, it's unnecessarily cruel. I don't need it. I don't need to. I've been online since 1995, doing it long before. I've been making podcasts since 2007, back when we called it making podcasts. Nobody does that anymore. So I've always found other places to go because there, at least for a little while, you could breathe easy because nobody's going to attack you for sucking at your job because they can compare you to somebody else. In film, I could get compared to absolute maestros of the genre or maestras. In podcasting, when I jumped in, it was me and Leo Laporte. Like, that was it. And Adam Curry, the godfather of podcasting, the guy that literally created the art form. So I was there before Joe. I was there before Adam. I was there before, like, Nerdist. I was there before Mark. You name it. We were there, like, in advance. And nobody could be like, you suck as a podcaster, because what were they going to compare it to? You know, now, of course, people could be like, you're no Joe Rogan. And I was like, well, all right. I can't argue there on some level. But like, you know, it's the shifts are a nice way to give yourself a breather from the thing that people could judge you for the most. It's also exploratory. As an artist, you know, it doesn't like stop with one medium. If there are other things that interest you, and because the one place that like pointed to you opens up other doors, you know, I've been spinning plates. Like back in the 90s, like I wanted to write comics and nobody was writing comics. You know, comics was a fizzling medium at that point. And I started writing Daredevil for Joe Quesada to draw with Jimmy Palmiotti. They had taken over a few titles at Marvel and put it under an imprint called the Marvel Knights. And so I remember my agent at the time, Phil Raskin, who now is like one of the partners of WME. He was like, why would you do this? He's going, what do they pay, $100 a page? How many pages are in the comic? I was like, 22. He's like, so you're going to make $2,200 to write a script for a comic book? He's going, I can get you a 1 week rewrite for $100,000. I was like, yeah, but you don't get it. Like, I love comics. They're going to let me write Daredevil. Like, that's it. It's not about career longevity. Right. It's not about making money. It's like, this is a dream come true. So because I got to follow that stuff turned out to be profitable. Like, you know, being the comic guy really helped when the whole world shifted into comic books. And people are like, well, why didn't you direct a comic book movie? Never had an interest in that shit. That's way too big. I love watching that shit. I would never want to make one. But being the comic book guy who's been talking about since 95, oh my God, I ate like off of comic books for the last 10, 15 years, comic book culture in a way that probably gave my career longer legs. I might have been done 10, 15 years ago, but for the culture shifting towards something that I was eloquent in speaking about, that I knew a lot about, and my opinions mattered. If the culture had shifted dramatically into sports, I'm left behind because I can't even talk about it. People are like, who's the GOAT? I'm like, the thing that's not the sheep. So, you know, I don't have a sports answer for it. But the culture shifted dramatically, thanks to Marvel Cinematic Universe, toward comics. And that allowed me to shift to something where they couldn't judge me as a filmmaker or whatever. They could be like, well, he seems to know a lot about comic books. And once again, that was a place where you can find respite from being torn apart as an artist for your chosen art form. So I've spun a bunch of plates for, I call it, for a lot of reasons, and it's turned out to be the smart thing. Every current artist that I speak to, I don't even have to advise them to spin many plates. They all know that you can't do one thing anymore. When I entered this business, you could have one field of excellence that you were studying, and perhaps you could get excellent in it. You know, that's the idea of creating a masterpiece, right? You basically work your whole life until you present this is meant to be the prime example of everything I learned to the person who taught you, and that's your masterpiece. You know, Chris Nolan has conducted a career, it seems, that is all about working toward the masterpiece, and we saw it pay off in spades, like recently with Oppenheimer. This was a man who concentrated on one thing. I'm a filmmaker, and I'm going to make films, and I'm going to win that Oscar, and he did. He had no distractions. I don't have that luxury. I got plenty of distractions, man, that I'm like, ooh, this looks fun, this looks fun. So I never concentrated everything on one field. That's not me saying, and that's why I'm not Chris Nolan. Chris Nolan's born to be a filmmaker, natural born talent. I don't have natural born talent to be a filmmaker, but kids, you don't have to play. You can watch, you know, people, there are people who get paid to play professional sports, I'm told, right? Like you can sit there and watch a person who's paid to play hockey, and that's exciting. Or you can get in the game, play hockey yourself. Now, you may not get paid to play it, like a Martin Brodeur back in the day or something like that, or a Wayne Gretzky. All my players, of course, are very old references. But you can enjoy the game of hockey. I used to love watching films, and I watched them from the sidelines. And then one day I was like, you know what? It was more fun than watching movies if I made one myself. And so I got into the game. Ain't the same game, right? Like when you go to a professional NHL game, oh my God, look at all the money all around you. Just like when you make a professional movie, oh my God, look at all the money all around you. But that don't mean you can't play a pickup game in the parking lot with like 10 people and a ball and you know, two nets, a ball and a bunch of sticks. Don't leave yourself out of something enjoyable just because like, well, I can't do it like they're doing it. Fuck them. That's how they do it professionally and stuff. Do it unprofessionally. I stand as an example of the outsider artist, you know, somebody who was like not to the manner born, didn't have any skills. And you ask any critic, they're like, he still don't got any. He's 30 years into the career. He still sucks. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter that I sucked because I wanted to play the game. And just because I wasn't born with the talent to play the game doesn't mean I don't have the heart to play the game, man. And there are many of us that are heart players. There are very few Chris Nolans in this world. The rest of the filmmaking industry is propped up by people who are just there because they love it so much they've willed themselves into that field. And I got to do that. So I always tell people, like, do the one thing, man, of course, like have your area of concentration. But kids, you can't just make a film anymore. You also have to be a salesperson. And who is a better salesperson for your art than you? There's one thing they taught us at Miramax from day one, which is like, you guys made this movie in black and white and there ain't a single fucking movie star in it. So how the hell do we fucking sell this? Well, we're going to stick you out there, the director who's got a fucking like crazy Cinderella story to tell about working in that convenience store and shooting that movie overnight. So go sing for your fucking supper. Nobody is going to sell this movie better than you. And so from an early age, because of the place I wound up working, which was Miramax, I had to learn to not just be an artist, but also be a salesperson in hockey. And I keep harkening back to hockey, and it's weird because I haven't watched it in a year, but in hockey, they have an expression called sell the game. If you love the game, you will sell the game, which means everything about it is something you pass off on to other people. You're like, oh, I got to take you to a hockey game. It's amazing. It's so fast. It's like no sport on the planet. I love the game of film, so I sell the game of film. I particularly love Kevin Smith films. I'm the world's biggest Kevin Smith fan. So I sell that game as hard as I can and have since the beginning of my career. I was the only one who can make the difference between somebody not going to see Clerks and choosing our movie as well by going out there and being like, this is how we did it, man. So every kid nowadays who's coming up, they have to be a salesperson as well. And, you know, in our art form, a lot of people hate it. We're like, oh, like I say, like, hey, man, I started as a filmmaker, but I've slowly gravitated toward becoming a salesman. And people like think that's like, oh, that's distasteful. I'm like, well, I don't have the fucking luxury of being Martin Scorsese, where I was born a filmmaker and I'll die a filmmaker one day. And I get to make classic films because people believe in my talent and stuff. I have to sell myself as a filmmaker. Every fucking time out. I've made 16 movies, kids. It gets no easier. doesn't mean that it can't be done, man. Like, basically, this is, for me, to exist as long as I have, is because I know how to modify my expectations. A lot of my filmmaking brethren and sistren don't know how to do that, because this is a field full of infantilized grown-ups who get to do what they want. Like, basically, every director is a baby, right? I want this. And like, quick, give it to him and stuff. That's his vision. Vision is nice and it'll get you somewhere and stuff, but it'll also cost a lot of money, and sometimes it alienates people as well. You have to be able to compromise, or, you know, people hate that word in this business too. Compromise, never. I'm an artist. Okay, change the term, man. You have to modify your expectations. Case in point, I've been married to a beautiful woman 25 years. In May, we'd be married 25. No, April. No, April would be married 25 years. Fuck, thank God she didn't hear that. In April, we will be married 25 years and whatnot. She's way out of my league. The only way we ever wind up as a couple is if she modifies her expectations. You know, she wanted to marry somebody probably compromise. Way better looking and whatnot. She, you know, like, she first came into this house years ago when Ben owned the house. Affleck owned the house that I'm sitting in right now. And when we came to see it in the summer of 2001, he was touring us around the house and whatnot. And beautiful, this house. And so he had to go take a phone call. And, you know, he was talking about how he wanted to sell the house. And he's like, I'll be right back. And he left. And my wife turns to me. She goes, I want this house. And I was like, well, then you married the wrong guy from Mallrats. He seems to be doing very well. So, you know, for me.
I just want to stop and say she's awesome.
She is. Yeah. I got lucky with her. She's very tolerant.
And I did too. So
yes. But kids, yeah, I don't have to give any modern storyteller advice about like how to be their own salesperson. They get that. But I will say that modifying your expectations will change the game. My wife wanted to marry somebody way better than me. She modified her expectations. We've been married 25 years. So in art, same thing, especially when people are giving you money to tell your story, man. A lot of people just want to be like, I do what I want, my vision. Like, that'll get you only so far, man, unless you win Oscars or make them a lot of money and stuff. But I suspect that I'm talking to people who are hard players who want to make it by hook or by crook and stuff. They're not worried about the big movie. They're worried about the movie that they're trying to make right now. So for those cats, just understand that, of course, you know you're your own salesperson and whatnot. Your voice is your currency, man. Like, basically, the world through your perspective is insanely valuable. A lot of people like to sheep it up and do something that was successful, copy somebody else's style, because that way could lie to possible success. Well, this formula worked. I'm going to do something like that. And it's also like, sometimes in life, you got to see it before you can be it. And so because of that, a lot of movies tend to be kind of similar and whatnot. Here's the news, man. They've been waiting their whole lives to meet you. The one person who's going to walk in and be like, here's a story you never heard before. People bitch about this business and they bitch about the studios. Oh, they just make sequels and remakes and stuff. Yeah, they do that. But at the same time, they're also waiting for you to walk through the door to tell them the story they've never heard before. They're like, oh, my Lord, we have to do that. Yeah, of course, that's it. That's the untold story, man. Like, basically, when it comes to me, you know, they've heard my shtick for 30 years. They know they're just going to get some variation on Clerks until the day I die and whatnot. And if they're into that, great.
They'll pay for untrue.
It. But if they're not into it, they'll shift away from it and stuff. What they've never heard from is all these cats. Like, that's who they're excited for. The person who walks through the door and tells them the story that they have never heard before. So never give up hope, because they are looking for you. However, don't wait for them. Because if you wait for help, you'll starve and die. No help is ever coming, kids. I'm 30 years in. I'm here to tell you there is no help. Some people try to use that on me in public, or like Q&As and stuff, or usually online with like, hey, I am where you were once. You have to help me. Difference is I never asked anybody for help, man. I put my movie on credit cards and whatnot and took it to a marketplace and sold it. So I'm being honest with you. No help is ever coming, man. You have to manifest this yourself. You have to take all the steps towards art before art takes a single step towards you, man. So if you dream about this sort of thing, I tell you, it's doable as hell. Especially, and I say that as living proof, man. Go back and look at my first movie. A chimp could have made that flick. So how it's made. It's what you're saying, what you're bringing to the table. Your voice is your currency. They have never heard your story before. and they're aching for it. They've never seen your perspective before. That's valuable. Don't sheep it up and do what others have done. If you're going to take a risk, like take a risk on you, because that's the thing you can guarantee they've never seen before. Plus, you can never guarantee success ever. 100%. This guy, Kevin Feige, probably has one of the best track records in this business. He runs the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? Every one of those movies makes tons of money up until lately. I guaranteed you, up until lately, every Thursday night when one of those flicks was about to open, Kevin Feige's asshole clenched super tight because even he don't know the future. For all he knew, it could turn out to be a massive flop, man. So nobody knows what success looks like. Nobody has the formula for it. If that's the case, you don't know if an audience is ever showing up to see your thing. So you can only guarantee success with one audience member 100%, and that's you, the artist. Just like they tell you on the airplane, you got to put your own mask on before you assist somebody else. Make it for you. Don't make it for someone else. Don't make it because it's going to open doors. Don't make it because it's the magic carpet that's going to take you to another place. You have no guarantees of that. The only guarantee you have is to make something that you love with your entire heart so that if nobody ever sees it or if the whole world sees it and hates it, you have guaranteed that you've succeeded because you've satisfied the most important audience member there was. I always say to myself two things after every endeavor, whether they succeed or not. And in most cases, this is more effective for when things don't work out. Because in those moments, you want to regret, you know, you want to go back into the past and relitigate and find depression and be like, why didn't I and stuff. So what I always say to myself is two things. Number one, you wanted this. Oh my God, you wanted this. You changed the entire structure of the universe to tell this dippy ass story. So you got to stand by it now. Just because shit didn't work out the way you wanted, don't you back up on it now. Like, you wanted this. Look what you did. You did it. So stand by it. And then the other thing I say is, what was the alternative? What were you going to do if you didn't do this? You know you have the ability to make this happen. This is not you trying to figure out some math problem. You've made a movie before. You know how to make films. So what was the alternative? You knew you could do this. If you didn't do it, it would eat at you inside like a cancer. So that's why it exists, man. What was the alternative? Those are the two most helpful pieces of advice I could pass on to any artist.
So now, what I would just say is that... that we may just have to release this episode as a monologue.
A great episode.
But I loved
also,
it.
My other advice, kids, let others talk.
Hey, like, we Kevin, have plenty of time to talk on
two,
this.
Two questions jumped out at me while you're describing it all, because I thought it was really great. Is the at one point in your life you decide to go to film school, and we spend a lot of time talking about film school on here, and you know, Katie's gotten all the way to a doctorate, and I've taught at a few places, and we've done other stuff. Dennis is a graduate from SCAD out in Georgia. And what I say a lot of times is literally what you just said in your monologue, the stuff about yourself, the stuff about modifying expectations, the stuff about, and the hard stuff. Like, you may fail, it may not work out. People, all the stuff you said earlier about criticism and being able to just stand up there and take the criticism. That's one of the things we talk about, that film schools don't spend a whole lot of time giving you all of that, because it probably would scare some people away. And my personal opinion is probably pessimistic in the sense that it's about getting their tuition, about like, we don't need to tell you how hard it is right now, because we're going to take your parents $80,000 first, and then we'll tell you how hard it is. But did you find that experience helped you much early on? I know you dropped out at some point, but was there anything other than you knowing you had to do it and you were working in the convenience store and you're like, hey, because I would argue, and again, you're very self-deprecating and humble and I respect that and love it about you. But I will say that maybe a chimp could have aimed the camera on those guys.
Right.
But the writing and what you put into writing, and I'm a person, one of probably 20, who read Kevin's version of Fletch years and years ago. And it's one of the best scripts I've ever read in my life. I mean, why that movie never got made, I will never know. But that's why I don't have the big job. But it was a great script. But Kevin, was there anything along the way, or do you, in your moments alone, when you're doing your self-affirmations, do you ever realize that, well, actually, I'm a pretty good writer. I'm actually a pretty good fan of, you know, comic books. Because you gave yourself a lot of credit for some of the comic book stuff. But I think... you also have chosen in that field to still make movies. Like, you could have heard that whole monologue and said, Kevin's never going to make another movie, right? Like, and you're in post on one right now, right? So it's sort of many questions, but the two key ones, at least of what we've been talking about, is was there any advantage to film school when you went? I know it's 30 years ago, whatever. And and why then, in a world where you're putting your up, you're going to be soon putting yourself up for that kind of criticism and the comparison to Nolan and whatever else, are you still doing it?
In terms of the first question, yeah, film school for me, I went to the Vancouver Film School and then dropped out. But the film school for me was about, you know, I learned some stuff. I went to an 8-month program. So it wasn't going to be a 4-year thing. It was one of the early attempts to streamline the film school experience. You didn't get a degree, you got a certificate of completion, which to my money was about as useful as a degree in terms of making guerrilla film or something like that. So they have them all over now, like the Los Angeles Film Academy, the New York Film Academy, the Hollywood Film Academy and stuff. Vancouver Film School was one of the first to kind of do it. And so when I went there, it was an 8-month program. I dropped out at the 4-month mark and I got to keep half my tuition and that went back into the movie. What they taught me some useful technical stuff. But it wasn't even a problem. I was impatient. I was 20. Let me see. I just saw Slacker on my 21st birthday. That was in August. February, I went away to film school. So I was 21 years old and I felt like, oh my God, I just discovered I wanted to be a filmmaker. Like, I'm 4 years late. I should have known this in high school because then I would have went to college for this. And so I can't afford to go to like a real college. NYU, Tisch, was at that point $40,000 a year. I was like, well, I mean, I would have to do 4 years undergrad before I even got to do the master's program where I could make a thesis film and stuff and follow the path of Spike Lee. So the VFS offered a cheap and quick solution, but they were training kids or students because they weren't kids. I mean, it was like I had people older than me in my class. They took from all over the world. They were an international school, but they were training their students for entry level into the Vancouver film and television business. So you would go from the VFS to probably, you know, working on Due South or whatever they were shooting in town back then at that time. And that, for me, I was like, well, I don't want to do that. I want to do what Richard Linklater did. I want to make an indie film and I want to sell it to a distributor and go to, you know, there was a path. I had read Richard's story and it inspired me. And I was like, that's the exact path that I wanted to follow. So film school, I don't care which school it was going to be, was probably never going to be my full path. I got enough education that I needed from the 4 months there in terms of how to edit, which would be a useful skill when we made the film. Learning basics, learning set etiquette, learning how to put together a beat board for as an AD, break down a schedule, things like that. Incredibly effective. When they got into theory, that's when I zoned out because I was like, I came for technical expertise. I don't give a fuck what this Canadian teacher thinks Jonathan Demme was trying to say with Silence of the Lambs. Like, fucking, I know what I think he was trying to say. And if it's theory, fuck it. Like, just tell me how to operate a Nagra sound recorder. Tell me how to operate a Steenbeck, a 6-plate Steenbeck, and edit a movie. I need these skills so I can take it back to New Jersey, teach my friends, and then try to make a movie myself. What was incredibly beneficial about Vancouver Film School, at least in my personal mythology, was that's where I meet Scott Mosier, who becomes my producer and my co-editor for years and my partner in crime for like a decade, for 12 years. And Davey Klein, who shot Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, and then came back for Clerks 2, Jersey Girl. No, not Jersey Girl. Clerks 2, Zach and Miri Make a Porno, Red State, a bunch of stuff. So those two kids I met, when I dropped out of film school, Mosier particularly was like, look, whoever finishes writing a script first, we'll go out to that respective country and make the movie. Scott presumably would make one in Vancouver. I would make one in New Jersey. Scott finished the script first. And I was like, great, I'll meet you out in Vancouver. And then I sent him my script. And Scott was like, we're not making my script. We're going to make your script. I said, why? And he was like, your script is camera ready. He's like, it reads like a screenplay that already got shot. He's like, let's lean toward this instead. So if I was left to my own devices,
just because podcasts have this sense, And I feel that a lot of people don't say stuff right to people's faces that they might say on a podcast, which to me is totally fucking insane that you'd say it in front of a bunch of strangers. But when we did, when we were talking to Scott, Scott's version of the story was, I was sitting there, I tried to be a writer, I was doing whatever. Kevin sent me a script, and I was like, well, I can't be a writer. I suck at being a writer. Kevin's too good at being a writer. I'm going to go produce this guy's film.
Meanwhile, cut to the present. Scott Mosier just sold a multi-million dollar script
to
Warner Brothers, you know, for Maude versus Maude. When I saw that in the trades, I was like, what the fuck, man? So I feel like I wasted the first 12 years of your career. And he was very sweet. He was like, if I hadn't worked with you on all those movies, if I hadn't done all that podcasting with you, he's like, I don't think I'd be doing this right now. He's going, but that gave me the confidence to kind of go forward and do my own thing and stuff. So, yeah, but he was without Scott, it wouldn't have happened. Scott brought Davey Klein into it because after I left film school, him and Dave kind of bonded. And Dave was, we called him Baby Dave because he was like 18 when he shot the movie. I was leaning toward trying to get the DP, John Thomas, who shot Metropolitan. Because he had an ad in the AIVF bulletin where you can hire him for $1,000 a week. He'd come in with a 16 millimeter camera and shoot your shit. But Scott was like, why do we want a pro in the mix? We're all amateurs. He's like, at least Dave knows as little as us, so nobody will be over anybody. And that logic made sense for something, for some reason. But it was the smart play. Without going to film school, I never would have met those two guys. And those two guys were absolutely essential to me getting to Clerks. If I had just gone home and tried to engage my friends, my local friends, the movie never would have happened. Scott would wake up every morning from the West Coast and put the movie together. It was never a discussion like, you're going to be the producer, until we were going up to do our credits up in the city. We were going to drop off the credits because they had to do, like, you know, the opticals and stuff. Yeah. And so I was like, well, do you want to be the co-director? And he's like, well, I didn't co-direct. And I was like, well, what do we call you? And he's like, well, I held the boom and I edited with you. I was like, I know, but you also like literally called like Spirit Corp to rent the equipment from the West Coast. Like, you came and you set the table and then came out here. We made the movie. So producer, like, you're maybe the producer. He's like, all right, maybe I'm the producer. So he kind of backed into producer. Without him, I never would have done it. Left my own devices. I don't think I could have whipped up enough enthusiasm with the people I grew up with to keep it going. We didn't finish a lot of things, me and my friends. Mosier, you know, had a sense of like, well, we'll start it and finish it. At least it'll be complete. And so that was the benefit of film school, is meeting like-minded individuals. That being said, you really don't have to do that now. If the internet had existed, I might have met Scott and Dave that way. But here's the thing. Sometimes you get done with high school, you got to go to college, right? You got those parents that are like, go to college. You know, if that's what you're supposed to be using that time to pursue your field. If my parents like were super wealthy and had offered me film school when I was, or even not even super wealthy, if my parents had enough money, they had two kids before me that went to college and they were all student loans. And so any cash the family may have had put aside for college didn't exist. I was going to have to get student loans. I got a few student loans to go to the Vancouver Film School. Paid those fuckers off right away after Clerks got picked up. Man, I was so happy about that. Fuck Sally May. So, at the end of the day, man, film school paid off for me, but just not in the traditional way. That being said, years later, because like I went off and made a film by the skin of my teeth, pulled myself up by my bootstraps, or they call that going to the school of life. And then colleges give you honorary degrees. So I have two honorary degrees and one doctorate. I'm a doctor somewhere. Nice. Like, one of the schools made me a doctor. And I always thought that was cool, but I always thought it was like, if I was somebody who paid for my education, I was like, you're just going to give this guy a fucking doctorate just because he got lucky? This is bullshit. Whole system's bullshit.
All right, so the second question, why keep making movies? Because you have successfully created yourself as a influencer, as a, you know, Comic Book Men was a really successful show. Obviously you're an actor and when you play primarily you or Silent Bob or whatever, but you're doing that. And what if it's a shark tank or Vipers, I think you said, what brings you back to it?
You know, I was at the ACE Film Editors Award. They asked me to give a Lifetime Achievement Award to John Waters.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, John Waters laid the track upon which my train has traveled for 30 years. If you don't do his shit, I don't get to do my shit. Like, he was one of the faces up on my Mount Rushmore of indie film when I was a kid. So afterwards, we were bullshitting backstage. And I'd seen that he was about to like make a movie for the first time in 20 years. And I was like, congrats, man. And he was like, yeah, it's going to be fun. He's going, but I'll be honest with you. He's going like, you know, if I don't make a movie, I'm standing on a stage somewhere like you telling a story. He's going, I found a lot of different places to tell stories. And I said to him, I was like, honestly, like I make more money standing on a stage talking about making movies than I do actually making movies. He goes, the absolute same. And he goes, what's the difference? He's going, at the end of the day, I'm telling a story. And I felt the same way. The only reason that I continue to pursue film, number one, I know how to do it, right? Yeah. And I built a brand and a brand name that, you know, makes it, I wouldn't say easy, but certainly makes it easier than most have it trying to get their idea from here out into the world. I got a pretty good track record of getting the movies I want to make made. Yeah, because I know how to modify my expectations. But as pointed out, I could spend, I do so many fucking other things that, like, why even bother subjecting myself to it? That's because 21-year-old Kevin Smith, like, set me up for life. That kid, I know that kid. I knew him back then. I know him now. He was a fucking idiot. Like, there was nothing about him that said, okay, you're going to say something and the world's going to stop and listen for however long or short. You're going to catch somebody's attention in the parlance of Steve Jobs. You're going to put a dent in the universe. The chances of that happening were insanely unlikely. Like I know that kid, but still that kid bet on himself and more importantly, bet on me. That kid was counting on being me one day. Like a guy who's going to be a professional filmmaker, that's what he does for a living and stuff. And so, you know, there's a philosophy of success that says that we're inherently lazy. You know, there's examples like you go to the grocery store and you're like, oh, I'm going to eat healthy this week. And you buy a head of lettuce and stuff. And then that head of lettuce goes in the fridge and slowly rots because you're never going to be better in the future than you are right now. Like we always plan for some golden version of ourselves that's going to get shit done. That version of me, oh, he's going to be the best in shit. But that's not true. That version of you is the current version of you. The best way to ensure success in the future is to literally build it now in the present, make it fucking foolproof and fail-safe so that future you just stumbles into it and suddenly the table is set for that person. That's how I kind of proceed through my life. 21-year-old Kevin Smith made an incredibly foolhardy choice and put himself possibly into debt with credit cards and stuff like that. Money he didn't have. Like, it's not like, Mom, Dad, can I have money to make a movie? Well, I did do that. And they gave me their life savings. They gave me $3,000, everything they had so we can rent the equipment in the beginning. So, you know, for me, it was for him, for that kid, he had this bizarre vision quest, man, where he just believed that it was going to work out. He believed that one day he was going to be me. And goddamn it if he wasn't right. That kid, like, he made this bold choice. And because of that, I have spent the better part of my last 30 years living fucking dreams come true on a regular basis, man. I've made 16 fucking movies. I'm heading into my 17th. And that ain't even the most, like, if you go down to Grauman's Chinese Theater, me and Jay have our handprints and feet in the cement. Like, you know, it's mind-bending what has happened over the years. And it's only because the 21-year-old Kevin Smith believed he was something so much that he made it come true. That kid, all he wanted, I remember, all he wanted was the world to look at him and say, you are a director. And the world did. And so everything that I've enjoyed for the last 30 years is on the back of that kid's one decision. And the one thing that kid ever wanted was to be treated seriously as a filmmaker. So even though I, in the present, know that filmmaking is one thing I could do, but I really don't need it to do everything that I do effectively in life and whatnot, I still do it because imagine I went back in time and told that kid, oh yeah, one day we can make any movie we want. We just choose not to because we're busy doing other things. Like that would break that kid's heart, shatter his fucking mind and stuff. So I do it still to honor the guy who started the journey, without whom I wouldn't be here. I've lived so well for 3 decades because of some decision that he made. And the only thing he wanted was everything that I can provide at this stage in my career. So I keep making them to honor. That's my thank you to the kid who got us here.
And I hate to go to this place. Yeah, that was very moving, which is why.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
This thing you've been very public about, and you mentioned earlier, even in this podcast, where you went away for a little bit. And did you find that kid? Was that kid and what you just said to us part of that experience? Or was
There was, when I was in, they kind of work on all parts of you. And I was able to identify 10 different Kevin Smiths, and they're all kind of like weirdly effective in their own way. And it's not multiple personalities, it's facets. You know, we're all like multifaceted, and as multifaceted as a fucking gem. And so some of those facets we adapt because they help us survive, whether personally in the real world or professionally and whatnot. So I, there's an authentic version of Kevin Smith, which you're probably getting mostly, except when I go into like joke telling mode and shit like that. That's authentic Kev. Then there's the guy I spent way too much time being, and probably still spend too much time being, but at least now I'm cognizant of it. A performative Kev. I call him the other guy. He's the person that I put on and, you know, hey kids, it's me, Kevin Smith. It's not what I fucking sound like in real life. That's, you know, me being performative. Because, I mean, honestly, that's what I learned through podcasting. I've been podcasting since 2007, so I've had to listen to my voice. And I love the sound of my own voice. Don't get me wrong. I love doing interviews and shit like that for years before podcasting. And the idea of podcasting was like, oh, my God, I got my own radio show. Why wouldn't I fucking do this? Yeah. But over years of hearing myself, like, you know, you learn to become more presentational, more performative, so you don't sound like a fucking NPR broadcast, monotone and kind of whispery and shit. So this version of Kev, the other guy, he's the one that jumps on stage and could do fucking 5 hours of Q&A or, you know, he's the guy who shows up on set. Because I feel I don't direct movies so much anymore as on set edit. I'm more proud of my accomplishments as an editor than director. I don't really think of myself as a director so much as an editor who happens to direct. And me not considering myself a director is cool, because most cats online don't consider me a director either. But when I go at it, man, like there's a bunch of different hats that I could potentially wear in any given situation. And it allows for me to be like, maybe I'll do a thing. Maybe I won't do a thing. Maybe like the last movie we made was the 4:30 movie, which tomorrow I will Zoom with the MPAA to try to argue it down. They gave us an R rating, like, which is fucking nuts, because the movie was designed as PG-13. And because, I don't know, because they honestly believe it, they watched the movie, gave us an R. And it's, you know, I've gone to the MPAA, met with the MPAA 4 times before and argued it down without having to make a cut. It's fucking ridiculous that if they see my name show up at this point, they should just be like, let him go. You know, he's gonna fucking do it. He's gonna whine about it, bitch about it, talk about censorship and fucking win anyway. So let's just have it. But maybe not. Maybe the new MPA is like, fuck that, man. We're gonna break his record. But I've done it 4 times before. I'm hoping to do it a 5th time here, just because it makes sense. This time I can actually come at it differently than I did before. Generally, when I've gone against the ratings board, it's as a filmmaker only. Now I own a movie theater. So I'm going in there as a member of NATO, a National Association of Theater Owners and shit. Like, I know what gets parents on their feet asking for a rebate. So I ain't got to listen to these cats anymore going like, hey, I'm on the first line of defense, man. I'm no longer some bougie filmmaker who doesn't go to the movie theater. I'm selling tickets as well to not just my movie, but other movies. So you can't tell me what PG-13 versus R is. Because if you're saying we're an R, then this movie, which is about set in 1986, about high schoolers, nobody even uses the word fuck, not even once, is on par with The Human Centipede. Your whole system is fucking broken. So I'll spend that time doing that tomorrow. And that makes life interesting sometimes. Like, you know, I'd rather that didn't happen, but it's nice to know I still care about some shit, right? Because as I was saying before, I don't direct so much anymore. I edit on set, but what I do mostly is host a movie. So if you're working on a Kevin Smith movie, oh my God, you're going to hear my voice all fucking day. And not because I'm screaming like Michael Bay, more because I'm constantly telling you at every given moment what's going on. I'm like, okay, kids, right now we're going to head into this scene, man. I got like four setups planned, but I bet you we can get there in three. I'm figuring maybe like one or two takes a piece. Before we do that, I'm going to open up the laptop and show you guys the scenes I cut from yesterday's footage. That's what I like to do when we make the movies, show the cast and crew the movie as I cut it, because I cut it like I'm the editor, so I cut it as we go along. And the more they can watch it, the more it goes from being like, you know, a theory, theoretical, like we're making this thing, to they're seeing it take shape. And there's no better like version of directing than actually, they call it monitor directing. Like when I'm, it works with cast and crew. When I'm done with the take, I bring the actors over if we've got playback, and I'm like, come here, look what you fucking did. And then I let them watch it. And if I have corrections, I'll be like, hey, man, can you go up on this line? Can you give me this? But more importantly, they're watching their performance. Nobody's going to be more self-correcting than the performer themselves, cast or crew. If you're sitting there watching scenes I've cut together as a crew member, you're seeing work that you did, and you're seeing like what made it and shit like that, and you're finding ways to improve it on set because you're seeing what you did the day before. Same with the actors as well. So I host a movie. Like I turn it into like a fun event because that's all I care about at this stage in the game. I want everybody leaving there going like, I had a good ass fucking time, because at this point in my career, what feeds my ego most is when people going like, have you worked on a Kevin Smith movie? Oh my God, it's so fucking fun. Like Kevin Smith's so fun to fucking work with. Like I love shit like that. Again, I've done it for 30 years. So every day you got to find new reasons to get into it. And now the new reasons is like almost like the old reasons. The old reasons were like, I want to be a storyteller because I want to spread fucking joy. There's enough misery in the world. We're all going to die one day. I want to be that distraction so people don't fucking think about that. And I still feel that way. But now I feel that way towards the people that make the stuff, too. I'm like, oh, my God. Because now there's a certain expectation. When I began my career, nobody knew who the fuck I was. 30 years in, people are like, well, fucking this guy. He's been around. So let's see what he's all about. You love to pleasantly surprise them all or meet their expectations. Where they're like, I always heard this kid was cool. Or let's be honest, this old man was cool. Like he turned out to be fucking cool. That is a big driver for me. And most filmmakers, like I'm sure, guarantee you talk to Chris Nolan. Chris Nolan's never going to say like, oh, of paramount importance is how the crew feels about shit. Like, no, but that's fine. He's, you know, that kind of filmmaker and stuff. For me, like, I remember there's a piece of advice that I got that wasn't handed to me, but it was Jason Reitman, who was on one of the podcasts I did like years ago. And he told me like this piece of advice that his dad, Ivan Reitman, had given him. Ivan Reitman said, if I could do it all over again, I would have made more movies. And his son was like, what are you talking about? He's like, I made Ghostbusters. Then after Ghostbusters, I got real choosy because I was waiting for the next Ghostbusters. He's going, but the thing is, they make one Ghostbusters in a lifetime. He's going, what I should have done was made as many movies as possible. Yes, some might have sucked, but some might have been great. He's going, it would have improved my odds. And so that's what Jason's mindset. He's like, well, I know in my life I'm going to make as many movies as possible. But when he said that, that like hit me too, where I was like, that's right, man. That's right. Like don't, when I began this job, I played it like every movie had the ability to save the universe. You know what I'm saying? Like that's how seriously I played this shit. That's why Clerks is effective and Mallrats is effective. Like they may not be much to look at, but you're like, God damn it, this motherfucker believes in what I don't know, but clearly he believes and stuff. Yeah. So, you know, passing that along through the work for years, people get a sense of like, you know, look, he ain't ever going to top this. I know a lot of people out there are like, he ain't ever going to top Clerks. And then there are people like, he ain't ever going to top Dogma. I've had people my whole fucking career from day one telling me I suck at my job, you know, and you know, they've been saying it for 30 fucking years. So who's right in that occasion and shit like that? At the end of the day, just keep your head down and make as many as you can. Liz Destro, who's my producer on the last few movies I've done, Liz just recently had this weird come to Jesus conversation with me where she was like, Kevin, you made a film during the pandemic. That was Clerks 3. She's like, and you made a film during two strikes. That was the 430 movie. We had a waiver because we weren't an AMPTP movie and our budget was like $2.5 million, $3 million. So she, after the rebate, $2.5 million. So she was like, you continue to make movies when she's like, and I can list very famous directors who were having projects shut down or just turned off. And she listed a few that were at Netflix that like blew my fucking mind, because these are buzzy fucking filmmakers. I'm old news and shit like that. She's going, but because you did the work you did all these years, because you built an audience that's fairly loyal and stuff and follows you around, because you continue making movies that aren't about your career, but more about just what you want to see, she's going like, you continue to work. She's like, keep doing it until they stop you from doing it, because they're stopping a lot of people from doing it. She's like, I don't know if you read the papers, but there's a lot of constriction going on in this business. It's getting harder and harder to get anything made. It's getting harder and harder to get cast in a thing. She's like, so if you find yourself, as you do, with the ability to make movie after movie, God bless and Godspeed. Don't fucking stop, because one day it may not be the case. And so far, knock wood, anytime I step up and go like, you know, I want to do a thing, it tends to work out.
That's awesome. Well, I just had a quick question, because we the other side of our audience that we're trying our best to get to is people trying to figure out how to watch movies and what to do. What made you buy a theater? And you clearly care about it, given what you just said. And was there something broken, or is it just for fun? Or
the place was in danger of like shutting down. There was this is the movie theater that me and my friends grew up going to in high school. I used to go to this movie theater with my father and stuff. We didn't have a movie theater in my hometown of Highlands, but right next door, the town of Atlantic Highlands had the First Avenue. It was called the Atlantic Cinema when I was a kid, then the Atlantic Twin Cinema when it became two screens, then the Atlantic Movie House because it became a multiplex. So biggest screen is 230 seats, small screen is about 100 seats. I'd gone to, you know, I stopped fucking with it after my career took off and whatnot, and because we had the comic book store in Red Bank still, Jane Silent Bob Secret Stash, and there's a movie theater there, the Count Basie Cinema, which we would go to for events because they could leave the store, go right there. But then a couple of years ago, I went to the Atlantic Movie House for some film festival, local film festival. And, you know, I was like, oh my God, this is it. This is the temple, man. This is the place that taught me to be what I wanted to be. Like, this showed me to movies, and one day I grew up to make movies. How sweet and whatnot. So there was a guy who post-pandemic, during the pandemic, the guy that owned the place had to shut it down. And he said, put out a notice. We're going out of business. Thank you for almost, at that point, 100 years in the community. It is over 100 years old, this movie theater. So Mr. Rass, he was Michelle Rass' dad. I went to high school with Michelle Rass. Mr. Rass had been the mayor at one point and stuff. He used to protect the Shah of Iran when he came over here and shit like that. Interesting guy. In any event, couldn't make it work as a movie theater after years and years because of the pandemic. He shut it down. So then there was another guy who came in, this dude, Tony, and he was like, can I make a deal where I rent the movie theater from you and, you know, I'll pay you for the business and percentage and blah, blah, blah. And the community was happy because the movie theater opened. And Tony kept it going as long as he could, but then it was clear that, like, film exhibition is in the fucking toilet, as I'm sure people have heard everywhere and stuff. So that's when it came back to me. My friend Ernie O'Donnell runs the place, Smodcastle keeper Ernie O'Donnell. He was like, you know, Mr. Rast is trying to sell the two buildings, and in the two buildings is the movie theater. There's also storefront shopping that you can rent out, you know, and stuff like that, and offices upstairs, but five screens across two buildings. And I was like, yeah, he had told me about that years ago and stuff. And he was like, which feel like, I don't know, they're going out of business. We could save it and shit. And I'd been like put aside some money because I wanted to buy Quick Stop where we shot Clerks and stuff.
Yeah.
But that deal fell apart. So I had this money sitting there. I was like, you know what, man? Like, we have a podcast theater called Smodcastle that was right next to Quick Stop. I was like, if we buy the movie theater, then we have Smodcastle Cinemas. We got five screens. Like, that podcast theater is a 50-seater. Like, we will have five theaters. The biggest venue is 230 and stuff. So me and Ernie and Ashley DeGennaro and Jeff Swan and Tony pooled our resources and bought the place. And so part of it was like, oh, we can't let this go down and whatnot. But part of it for me was like, oh my God, I got a venue where I could constantly victory lap everything. You know, like we've been for years holding Volgathons, mini film festivals, all the movies I've made. Right. You know, we'd rent out the Count Basie Theater or something like that. I was like, now I've got a theater. We could just do events here. So film exhibition's still in the toilet. First run movies don't do business for us. Avatar 2, inarguably one of the biggest movies of the last, you know, 5 years and shit. Our Friday night opening, 12 people were there. Creed 3 was a massive success. Our Friday night opening, six people were there. One walked out because he didn't realize it was Creed 3. The Nun 2, one creepy person showed up on a Friday night and watched it by themselves.
That tracks.
So new movies like aren't bringing them in. But when we show Jaws, 200 fucking people show up. We showed a Muppet movie, 175 people show up. We show any of my things, we sell out. So we'll do events like Clerks open all night, where we showed all three Clerks movies from midnight till 6 in the morning. You slept over in the theater and shit like that. We've shown Mallrats with Jason Lee and Jeremy London. We've shown Tusk with Justin Long and Genesis Rodriguez. George R.R. Martin came because he's from New Jersey, and just like we did a Q&A with him. The Russo brothers came, and I just Q&A'd with them as well. We got an event coming up in August called Vulgarthon, which is like our mini film festival. This year we're going to show all of the Askewniverse movies, all the movies I made that were interconnected. So it's like 8 movies: Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, Clerks 2, Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, and Clerks 3. And $69 a ticket. And so you watch movies for like 20 hours and shit with Q&A between it. So we thought, like, you know, generally when we sell out the 230-seater, we feel great because that's anywhere from a $10,000 to $20,000 night or something like that. Makes up for all the other nights that aren't that whatsoever. Right. But the Vulgarthon thing, like, looking like it's going to create an event for us that's like newsworthy, because we've sold out the first theater, and then the second theater sold out, and then the third theater sold out. So now we're almost sold out on the fourth screen of Vulgarthon. That leaves only the 100-seater left, which means if we could sell them all out by August 3rd, literally every seat in that house will have been sold. And that's something that has probably never happened in the history of that theater, that every single seat was sold. So we could fundraise like that. Recently, after a year and change in business, I was like, kids, let's go nonprofit. Like, you know, it'll help if we can turn to the state and be like, hey, help us out, or the federal government or something like that. Or we live in the movie theater resides in a pretty wealthy enclave on the Jersey Shore, and everybody and their mother has thanked me since I kept the place. Oh, you saved the theater, and thank you for that and stuff like that. So if we're a nonprofit 501c, we could turn to the community and be like, how much do you love this fucking theater and stuff? So you know, it's just it'll make it a little easier on me, because for the first year and change, it was me doing event after event after event, and I literally carrying this motherfucker across the finish line. So by going nonprofit, like the Jacob Burns Center, which is in just outside of Manhattan and stuff, Westchester area and whatnot, or like Vidiot's in Eagle Rock out in California, near Los Angeles, you know, going in a nonprofit direction, it makes it safe. It means we can keep that fucker open and stuff, and also let the community, involve themselves beyond just buying tickets. So it's been soul satisfying, to say the least. It's having our own little clubhouse. We do shows constantly. It's a big fat museum of me. So it's a museum, like, you know, all the walls have giant posters of everything I've ever done and stuff. So it doesn't hide, you know, I certainly don't shirk my accomplishments. I'm like, look at this shit, 30 years of Jay and Silent Bob. So it functions as that as well, but it's,
how much time do you spend out there?
A lot. Like, I go out about 2 weekends at least per month and do events. So I just got back last night because I was there. We did a comedy show on Saturday that was a fundraiser for my high school's athletics club. And then we did a Jersey Girl 20th anniversary screening on Sunday afternoon. And then before that, I had gone out 2 weeks before that to do like a double day of events and stuff. So I go out quite a bit, and there's an apartment above it. So when I go out, like, I get to stay there and shit. As a filmmaker who lives in a movie theater. There's like a cobbler who lives in a giant shoe. It's just adorable. So, but film exhibition is like, it's dying. I just did a big interview with Variety where they were doing a piece on like exhibitors who were figuring out how to keep it going in a world where like people just aren't going to the movies like they used to and stuff. And so we have the ability to pivot and do live shows. We did a Superman Live script reading there We've done the comedy shows. We've had music come in there. So we don't use it strictly as a movie theater. You know, it's like, look, you got a bunch of seats in a front of a room with a mini stage. You can do any number of things there.
Right.
So we have more flexibility than Carmike Cinemas or an AMC. And then there's also the ability to like, hey, let me bring a famous person in. And then the community gets interested and like shows up. But it's, you don't do it because you're like, we're going to get rich. You do it because you fucking love it. Like, right. Seriously, it's, and I don't mean that, you know, like, oh, owning a movie theater is the toughest job you'll ever love. This is not first world bitching and shit, but it's just not a financially lucrative business. Essentially, you are in the candy business. Like, that's how we make right. money is off candy and fucking popcorn.
Do you think that's our permanent state, that people are going to keep it at this level for theaters and stuff?
Most people are adapting by shrinking their hall sizes. So they don't have the standard movie seats side by side by side because they're like, look, 250 people are never coming back. So they've scaled their halls back to like maybe 100 or 75 and they put in real or 25 and they put in those real nice seats and they right. premium it up. Most places have a liquor license so they could sell booze. That's something we'll investigate somewhere down the road and stuff. I'm just not ready to go that route yet. Like, and yet, and people tell us like how uncomfortable our fucking seats are. Same seats that have been there since the 60s, but there's something authentic about it. Like the place looks like it was frozen in time, so much so that when we bought it, I was like, oh, I'm going to write a movie for it. And that's the movie that I just finished, the 4:30 movie. It's set at that movie theater. And in terms of art direction, Rat Face, Robert Holtzman, our production designer, literally was just like, just fucking turn around and shoot. Like he didn't have to turn it in. It's set in 1986. And he didn't have to do anything to set it in 1986. The theater just looks period to begin with. And stuff.
Well, when does that come out? When can we see the movie?
I'll probably tour it in July. And I think it comes out first week in August. They haven't even announced, like we kept it quiet because we made it during the strikes. And Sarah Silverman seemed awfully upset with people that were making things during the strike. So I didn't want to incur her wrath. So we never even announced it. I think they're releasing, doing a press release pretty soon to say who bought it and what the story is and all that shit.
That's awesome. Cool. Well, I hope you keep doing them for the 21-year-old Kevin and for the 55-year-old Chris.
Yeah.
55? Do you got me by 2 years?
I do. I'm an old man.
I thought of you
dude.
As an elder statesman. I always thought of you as younger. That's good to know.
God bless you. That was the whole reason for the podcast. It just took us a long time to get there, Kevin.
That was finally got the compliment.
Finally achieved it. That was the end goal.
But seriously, man, we really appreciate your time, and I hope you keep out there. If there's anything we could ever do for you, we really, really appreciate it. And you were one of those guys, and you've stayed one of those guys, whatever the ups and downs might have been, for those 30 years. And
thank
you. Should be happy about that, because this business can twist you up in certain ways, and you've
it's
definitely...
true. It's true. Well, yeah, it certainly did that. But like, you know, you can always get right. There are people out there who can always like help you get right again. And everyone, honestly, every creative, man, that's another thing. Like, quick word about mental health. Every creative, look out for that. We're sensitive people, man. You know, like, I know. Snowflake has been turned into a terrible word by some people and whatnot. It's not terrible at all. Snowflakes are individual and absolutely different from one another and shit. But the one thing we all share as artists is vulnerability, because you have to be vulnerable to share, you know, what you're feeling, what you're thinking. Right. And that vulnerability leaves us wide open for all sorts of mental duress, you know, because we're creating something that is going to be seen. We don't make this shit in a vacuum. We make it and turn it over to people and say, what do you think? And some people don't think the way we do. And some people are kind of cruel about it. So always leave space for yourself to step away from all that. And remember that, like, the Sturm und Drang, kids, at the end of the day, it's just like, you're here for a minute and then we're fucking gone. So make sure that you take time for your head and heart, not just for your career. It's great to be ambitious and it will get you places and stuff, but sometimes the ambition has to be set aside and you got to take care of oneself.
Literally nothing more needs to be said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amen.
Thank you so much, Kevin. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming on. And as you do, obviously for everybody, check us out on our socials, follow our podcast and tune in every Thursday for a new episode. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin. Yeah.
Thanks again,
thanks,
man.
Thanks, kids. Yay. Such a pleasure.